Hello, and welcome back to Elder Sign, a weird fiction podcast by Clay Temple Media. I'm Glenn McDorman.
And I'm Brandon Buddha. Today we'll be taking a look at Book Hounds of London. This is a, I don't know, setting and adventure role-playing book written by Ken Haidt for the RPG Trail of Cthulhu. This came out in 2011.
Yeah, this is the second in our ongoing series on role-playing games in weird fiction. I say ongoing, but of course, really, it's going to be just this year. There's seven of these we're going to cover. This is the second. It is also the second book that's written by Ken Haidt, second in a row. We're 100% Ken Haidt role-playing games so far, but I will say that this is the end of that road. Trail of Cthulhu, we should say a little bit about, I suppose. Trail of Cthulhu is a Cthulhu mythos game. It is set contemporary to Lovecraft's stories. More specifically than that, it is contemporary to the later stories. So really what we're talking about here is the 1930s. And the game uses the gumshoe system, which is a system used in a lot of games published by Pelgrane Press. The system was designed by Robin Laws. And what this means really for this game is that it is more of an investigative game than a combat simulator, though, you know, you can still fight stuff if you want to in this game. And basically, Trail of Cthulhu is that Ken Haidt wanted to rewrite the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game to suit his taste. We're going to be covering some of the Call of Cthulhu later on this year, so perhaps we'll compare some notes at that point. But let's talk about how we got here. Trail of Cthulhu is a really important game if what you're into is weird fiction role-playing games. People voted for us to cover something from Trail of Cthulhu. I mean, like, voted for it in droves. I selected this one, this module, or this setting book, rather, for us to cover because it is basically the exact plot of The Club Dumas by Arturo Perez Reverte. This was adapted into film as The Ninth Gate. This is a book that we both love, but you, Brandon, actually included Perez Reverte on your list when we did an episode about writers we love but who are outside the purview of the network's shows. That was an episode we aired on Patreon, I guess, 3 years ago, something like that. But at any rate, when I realized that Ken Haidt had taken that novel and turned it into a Cthulhu mythos role-playing game, it just seemed obvious that we were going to cover it.
It's such a good choice. Yeah, I do love that novel. I like a lot of Perez Reverte's mystery novels. I haven't read any of his Captain Elatrice adventure novels. That's kind of, I think I'm saving that for my early retirement years when I'm 87 or however old I get to retire, thanks to our wonderful policies in this country. But yeah, Perez Reverte is great. It's out of fashion to say anything positive about Roman Polanski films, and I understand why, but I do like that film, The Ninth Gate, quite a bit. I love the soundtrack as well. And I love this setting book. This is really awesome. And you're right to point out that Ken has taken, you know, kind of the archetype of that Lucas Corso character, who is a book detective, basically, or a book finder. In this setting, he might be known as a book scout, and taken those ideas and turned it into a Cthulhu mythos game, but also one that is rooted so deeply in historical research. I think, did a lot of research for this module, at least. I want to say one more thing before we kind of get into some of the locations as well, which is that Ken Haidt and Robin Laws, who you mentioned, who designed the gumshoe system, have a great podcast called Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff. I can't remember, Glenn, if you and I found that independently of one another and then we're like, we're listening to this, or if you told me about it, or what have you. But a lot of interest, I think, to people who like our show over there on Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Yeah, I know that a lot of our listeners do listen to that show. So it was absolutely no surprise that a lot of the Ken Haidt materials on our ballot were voted for. Yeah, let's do a little more orienting here before we get specifically into this. And, you know, we're going to not spoil The Ninth Gate or The Club Dumas for people here. But right, it is about a dealer in rare books who gets sucked into some conspiracy stuff, maybe also some supernatural stuff. And that is what Book Hounds of London is. Here in this setting, the Book Hounds of London setting for Trail of Cthulhu, you play a dealer in rare books, of course, rare books of the Cthulhu mythos variety. So obviously you can think here about the Necronomicon or nameless cults. Those are just the tip of the iceberg, of course. And the story, or really, you know, gameplay maybe is the word I should use here. But at any rate, that starts with investigating a book or something adjacent to a book and then getting in, you know, sucked into something that's cosmically horrifying. We're going to talk about the canned adventure that Haidt has written for this setting. We'll also talk about some of our own ideas. But before we get to that, let's talk about the setting itself, which is London in the 1930s. Haidt breaks down London into five or six sections. We're not going to cover them all, but we have each picked one to talk about. I've been monologuing for a while. So Brandon, let's start with you. What part of London do you want to talk about here?
Well, I want to talk about the way that Haidt conceives of London as a city, you know, the city center, perhaps, and also what it means to be in London in the 1930s. I know you're gonna look at maybe more of a discrete section, but I think it would be helpful to give a kind of an overview of where Haidt is coming from, thinking about the history of London. And Haidt really has some nice historical information, as I've alluded to here, about the city of London, much of which I think will not come as a surprise to those who are history buffs, particularly British history buffs. Perhaps, you know, you've read Peter Ackroyd's whole series on England or something like that. But, you know, we are dealing with a London more or less concurrent with 1930s London. And so we've got smog and we've got the tube. We've got these sort of modern things, or things we think of as being a part of modern London. But there's also the sense of, you know, the fact that Rome occupied London, this section of the British Isles, for 400 years in the past. And maybe that might interest an occult bookseller to some degree. And it might affect the way you understand what the city of London is in an historical sense and also in an occult sense. You know, what might be buried beyond the city limits in chapels built upon Roman ruins and so forth. This can give you a sense of the atmosphere and place beyond just the industrial grime and so on that might occupy your imagination and be informed by great figures of British letters like Dickens and Shakespeare. But really, I think it's important to keep in mind, and what Haidt wants us to keep in mind, is that we are in the interwar period. We're, you know, a couple years out from World War I, and there are technological realities that are built atop ruins of the ancient past. And so there are cars and horses, for instance, you know, running amok through the ancient alleyways of London town. And there's, you know, ruins beneath the tube. I also think it's important to keep in mind that though historical facts and archaeology and artifacts and all of these real connections to the past are here for us to draw upon, we are meant to think about how the history of the legendary founding of London and England, more broadly speaking, might go back to Troy, or might be dealing with giants like Gog and Magog. And why do Welsh words look so much like Cthulhu language, things like that, and how all of this might tie into the Cthulhu mythos. So this is all really here to draw upon. Haidt has done an amazing job of pointing out not just the historical realities of London in the 1930s, but the way that London was built upon Roman ruins, for instance, or Druidic conceptions of reality, or, you know, the Welsh language, which I guess is a joke everybody likes to make. But we are in this huge period of change in London as well, in the city, where we've got new wealth that are the result of industry and war and crumbling aristocracies. Ancient and medieval histories are all here to play with. And then the mythos stuff is really at the heart of the campaign. And I guess that's the city of London as Haidt has envisioned it for our purposes.
Right. Just to be clear here, because city of London means something very specific, and you're actually not using it in that sense. You really are talking about metropolitan London here. The city
is actually
a neighborhood in London. And so just to clarify there, though, many of the things that you're talking about are actually only applicable to that neighborhood called the city. It's a very complicated thing where the city of London and metropolitan London are, in fact, two distinct legal entities as well. They have distinct police forces. This is something, you know, if you've read or watched anything about Jack the Ripper, you become aware of, we'll be talking more about Jack the Ripper later right. in this episode. But the city of London, the neighborhood called the City of London, this is where most of the material stuff, most of the landscape, the cityscape of London, or that people think of when they think of London, is there in the city. This is where you know, St. Paul's Cathedral is. It's where the Tower of London is, and so on. It's not where Big Ben is. That's over in Westminster. But many of the things that people associate with London iconically are in the city. And that is the part that is built over the Roman foundation. In fact, some of that wall is still there and so on. So yeah, a lot of the things you were talking about are specific to that that part of it. And yeah, and yes, Height does, yes, I think, yes. And Height does, I think, a really wonderful job here of, you know, giving us some weird ways, or ways to make those locations seem really weird, or to do something, you know, Cthulhu mythos with them, which is a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. Yeah. And I should have been more clear about the way, you know, the city limits of London are different than the city of London here. I peppered that in perhaps too obscurely in my description here. But yeah, he is really interested in history here, and, you know, the bookshops that you might be visiting. And yeah, it's a fantastic bit of work, I think, Height has done in giving us this setting for this this Trail of Cthulhu campaign or adventure.
Well, I'll take us into some more specific details here. I did actually choose one of Height's, you know, five or six locations here. I didn't choose the City of London. I chose the East End of London because it's, well, it's just my personal favorite part of contemporary London, but also a fantasy version of 19th century East End of London has been a setting for, you know, two of my Henslow occult detective stories. The East End is exactly what it says in the box. It is the eastern part of London. It begins right at the edge of the neighborhood called the City of London. It includes the Whitechapel neighborhood, which, you know, everyone has heard of because it's where Jack the Ripper did most of his ripping, though, you know, some bit of ripping was done in the neighborhood called the City of London. Until recently, the East End was the industrial center of London, and so factories and warehouses abound here. It's also where the docks are. Well, I mean, that's not true anymore, but it's where the docks used to be. So, you know, if we're talking about the 1930s, which we are, it's where the docks were in the 1930s. As I said, we are going to return to Whitechapel in a bit because we're going to be talking about Jack the Ripper. So let me just hit a few of Height's East End story hooks here that I think are really fun. And let's start with warehouses. Height gives us a pretty nice story hook about some rare shark skin that is used to bind books that is just sitting in a warehouse, really just waiting to be stolen by some industrious book forger. But the person who told you this also claims to have seen a person with his limbs chopped off, or possibly even bitten off, in this very same warehouse. So, you know, the story hook here is really good luck with that, right? It's a break in, unexpected things happen. And that's a kind of fantastic bit of, you know, I guess you could do that as a dungeon crawl.
What interests me most about this type of setting, it's a little bit more of a life sim. I mean, we talked previously about Vampire the Masquerade and how that's kind of political. That's a lot of conversation. A lot of the mechanics of this book are caught up in an auction. You know, a lot of these objects, occult objects or books, are going to go to auction. And so a big part, I think a big centerpiece of each of your campaigns are going to be dealing with this auction house business, and maybe there's ways to do heists and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, it's a fascinating approach. It's kind of a mix between dungeon crawl and monsters, which are all here and optional, and you can do a lot with that. But remember, your main character, player character you're creating is a person who's really into hunting down books, which may not make them a great cleric, you know, or something along those lines.
I'm going to give two more of Height's, I guess, kind of tidbits here, little high points, highlights of, you know, this weird fiction version of London that he's inventing here. I'll do this pretty quickly, but something else that is here in the East End is the Liverpool Street train station. And here there is a portable bookshop. It's a, you know, a little business. It's a book cart, really, right? It's a person, it's a bookseller with a book cart. It sells a lot of porn. That's, you know, what this sort of thing is for in the 1930s. We're going to return to that, actually. But also, for some reason, this book cart has a lot of 18th and 19th century books, some of them, of course, bound in human skin. But the book cart is never in the same place twice. And, you know, this is just a little paragraph that Haidt has here in the book, but it brings a lot of life to this location. And then Haidt also tells us about one of the most famous weird residents of the East End. This is a person named Samuel Falk. He lived there in the 18th century. He was an alchemist and a Kabbalist. Falk was known as the Baal Shem of London, and he was a really important occultist of his day. But after his death, he became a figure of local folklore, and there are a lot of stories about him doing bizarre alchemical things, often in the service of the local Jewish community, and he may have buried some treasure in Epping Forest, which is just outside of London. Strangely, or at least strange to me anyway, Hike's hook here is not actually that treasure, but rather the fact that Falk's will dictated that his alchemical books be locked up and hidden away after his death. And as far as we know from the historical record, the executor of his will did exactly that. But then he himself, the executor, died the next day, and no one has seen these books since. The hook here is, maybe it's time someone did, right? And I think you can see where, you know, just these little details flesh out this world, give us a sense of the weird present, but also the weird past of London, and are themselves nice little adventure hooks if you want them to be.
It's really, yeah, as I said, it's really, really amazing the amount of research I think that Haidt put into this. Cults and the occult were a big deal in the 19th century. You're caught up with, you know, mesmerism, mediums, talking with the dead, occult societies, people like Aleister Crowley, and so on. And a lot of that stuff is here and feeding Haidt's imagination to create this world of 1930s London. Not enough cocktails in this book, I'd say. Not enough cocktail recipes. But other than that, it's really on point.
Yeah, I definitely will say that that was something I felt was missing from this book, was a sense of there being a jazz age happening in London, which certainly there was. Though we'll get into that a little bit when we start talking about some of the mythos cults, which maybe we should just move into now, which Haidt has a whole section here on mythos cults and what they're up to in London that can serve as story hooks. We've each just picked one to let listeners know about. Brandon, who are you going to talk about here?
I'm going to talk about the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh, and this is a cult that is connected to the Egyptology craze that grew out of Napoleon's 1799 expedition to Egypt, and then the subsequent exploration of the Valley of the Kings in Egypt. And so in Egyptology Hall opened in Piccadilly in 1815 and was largely filled with Napoleon's looted plunder of those tombs that he found that were, you know, or his campaign or expedition found that were discovered, you know, around that time or before. This is a 16-year period, right? So the Brotherhood is kind of headquartered in this Egyptology hall, and mostly what they're into is artifact smuggling. They're a big artifact smuggling ring. But they do worship Nyarlathotep and use his power, the power of the Black Pharaoh, to deal with their enemies, foes, and, you know, one supposes any sort of inconvenience to their business, you know, traffic's moving too slow or something like that. And so what they do, you know, is they like to collect manuscripts. Maybe they're really into a writer like Ludwig Prynne. So if you come across something that interests this brotherhood, you may be running into them throughout your dealings. They are really not want to suffer foes at all, and they just want to keep their smuggling ring a secret and to keep their power intact, their power from Nyarlathotep, who is, you know, from Lovecraft stories.
this is a great way to do something, really anything that you might like to do, but just, you know, something with Egyptology here in your game, which was certainly a big rage. Egyptology, you know, there's a huge craze of this really beginning with Napoleon's expedition and, well, maybe never really dying down. I guess people still really love Egypt, even if it's just to speculate about exactly which type of alien built the pyramids and that sort of thing. But yeah, it's definitely something that you can do here, right? If you want to have your character be doing something at the British Museum, for example, or you know, any of the museums in Oxford or Cambridge and that sort of thing. It's a way to have your characters doing things that skirt around some of the other mythos areas, which are very European heavy, where we've got people like, you know, John Dee and Vermius and so on. If we're thinking about the Necronomicon and nameless cults and other things, this is a way to get a little get a different flavor, I guess, in your game here.
And also really be in touch with the black market. I think that is another really important part of this kind of imagination behind this secret book trade and occult objects. Is you need smugglers, you need a black market, you need contacts in all rungs who are of society who are participating in this. And this is one way you can have the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh, you know, expand their smuggling ring to keep their business. Maybe they're the core artifact smugglers, the best in town, and you've got to deal with them in some way. So a lot of really rich ideas to mine, even within just a small cult like this who worships an obscure Egyptian dream deity.
Right. You could have the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh in your story simply in this capacity as smugglers, right? Like you and your other player characters are trying to smuggle something in or out of London that may have nothing to do with Egypt, may have nothing to do with Nyarlathotep, but nonetheless, these are the people who are good at smuggling, right? So you need to go to them in some way. And then, of course, everything can start to go wrong if that's the type of scenario that you have in mind. But yeah, there's lots of ways that characters could come into contact with the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh. I decided to talk about one that, I don't know, might not be to our taste in the types of stories that we like to tell, and certainly not maybe the types of stories we like to play. And this is a cult called the Kyrekeres, and this cult worships Igolanok, who is a great old one invented by Ramsey Campbell in his 1969 story Cold Print, which is a story I would love for us to cover someday. That story involves a bookseller, though that is not actually like the connection that Haidt is making here. Haidt is really thinking of this cult as a sex cult that is run by classics professors. Obviously, that is why I picked this one. I have a degree in classics. I just found this idea kind of funny, also maybe kind of disturbing. In fact, I mean, it is disturbing. It's deeply disturbing. The cult deals in pornography, also drugs. It is, though, also seriously into Igolanok, and, you know, the cult is not merely an excuse to throw sex parties, though it is also an excuse to throw sex parties, but it is, at its core, into some serious mythos business. And this cult is influential in academia, the arts, also leftist politics in 1930s London. All of this really where it intersects at the University of London, and then also in London's film scene. And Haidt suggests a few story hooks for this cult. One of them is that they deal in pornography, which in the 1930s means books. So you could have something like that going on. And here we might even think about Lovecraft's story, The Picture in the House, which doesn't really deal with pornography, actually deals more with what we would call carnography, I guess, right? Showing people doing awful things to bodies, though I guess your pornography can be that as well. But anyway, point is, Lovecraft has dabbled in this a little bit himself, so you could take that as a, you know, a story prompt for a setting or for a scenario that you might want to come up with here for Book Hounds. Another hook, though, is that this cult itself is after copies of The King in Yellow and other occult books, and that's definitely a way your player characters could have some business with them. But also, if you are playing a character with any kind of vice, you might have that character come under the thumb of the cult, or rather, you know, the game master might have your character come under the thumb of this cult and have to get out from under that thumb in some way. So this in all is really a lot more lurid than I really care for, but I do think that it captures an important element of interwar London, could make for some fun storytelling. And especially, I think this is the place where if what you want is some jazz clubs with cocktails, this might be an angle to get in there and get some intersection with, you know, old books as well.
It shouldn't be, you know, knowing you, so hard to imagine a classics professor running a cocktail bar, but it does seem rather far-fetched, though. I think if anybody could pull it off, it would be you, Glenn.
Yeah, literally a thing I have done for a few years of my life. So yeah, absolutely could be done.
This is the secret history, like Donna Tartt's novel, you know, picking up on that obsession with Dionysianism in you know, the classics majors and so on that you see around. Even with, you know, later on, I don't know if we'll bring them up, even with Aleister Crowley's Call or the Golden Dawn or whomever that like Yeats was a part of, this weird obsession with the magic from, you know, that's found in classical texts and so on, and primarily with debauchery. And so bacchanals and sex magic and all of that stuff that was kind of really being investigated by a handful of people in this interwar period.
Yeah, I was really reminded of the Roderick Burgess cult from Sandman, specifically from the very first issue of Sandman, Sleep of the Just, in which we have a cult that basically mirrors Aleister Crowley's cult. It's, you know, the 1920s, though we do see them in the 1930s as well. And, you know, that story tells us the story of dreams imprisonment for 80 years. So we go through almost all of the decades of the 20th century. And by the time we get to the 60s, the son of the original founder of that cult is still running it. But it's clear that at this point, most of the people involved in the cult really do think that it's just an excuse for sex parties. And so this line that, no, there's also actually some serious stuff that we're doing here is straight out of Sandman. And I really felt like Ken Hite had that in mind here when he was detailing this cult. Well, let's move on. We're zipping through this in pretty good time here, Brandon, so we can maybe spend a little more time on the canned adventure that we get here. This is called Whitechapel Black Letter. We're not going through this beat by beat. This is going to be just an overview. And Whitechapel Black Letter is a story really about the secret behind Jack the Ripper's killings, which were only 40 years previously. You know, for us, it's been over a century, but from the perspective of the 1930s, this is just something that happened only 40 years ago. And the weird idea here is that the locations of the murders, if you plot them on a map, they outline the Eye of Beatus. Beatus is a horrific mythos entity pinned beneath London. Beatus is an invention of Robert Bloch's, first appearing in his story, The Shambler from the Stars. Beatus was then appropriated by Ramsay Campbell. I do think it's really the Campbell version that Hite is using here. But, you know, I would love to cover any of these stories at some point. I think it would be really fun for us. But let's get back to this story here. So you might immediately assume that Jack the Ripper was trying to summon the Eye of Beatus. But in fact, he was offering a sacrifice to Beatus's rival, who is another mythos entity, this one named Nodens. Nodens is a real world god, I should say. This is from pre-Christian Britain. But Nodens really gets into, appropriated, I should say, into weird fiction because he's used by Arthur Machen. And that is the version that Hite is employing here, though Nodens gets used by August Derleth and loads of other people. But it's really the Arthur Machen version here. We will, I'm sure, someday, you know, get to where Arthur Machen is actually using Nodens. But at any rate, what Hite envisions here is that Beatus and Nodens were rivals for control of London, though neither has any immediate ability to affect our world here in the 1930s. But the Ripper was attempting to magically close the Eye of Beatus so that Nodens would be able to come out and play, I guess, you know, might be one way that we would think of that. But the Ripper did not complete his task. Of course, we don't know why. We don't really know who the Ripper was. We don't know, you know, why his killings were interrupted. And it turns out that now others are interested in completing this task. But then, of course, still other people are interested in getting the Eye fully open. So yeah, that's the hidden weird element that the characters will eventually uncover. I'm going to pause here, but we will talk about the plot setup in just a moment. But I do want to chew on this premise a little bit first, because I love the idea that these prehistoric gods that are associated with London were actually powerful mythos entities trying to establish rival, but also immediately neighboring cities as sources of power, and that now today they are buried underneath the sprawling metropolis of London, just waiting to get out again. That's an awesome hook here.
What works so well about it too is the idea that you are just some, you know, book detective basically who's just trying to find a book, and you end up in this sort of battleground between these two ancient old gods or elder gods, and the two sides that are kind of at war, in a sense, trying to have their god defeat the other one or become more powerful enough to maybe vanquish the other one or something along those lines. And along the way, you're going to solve the mystery of Jack the Ripper or something along those lines. And Haidt, again, has done a lot of research into the Ripper murders. He's picked his own perspective, his own point of view on who might have done it and why that person did it for the sake of this campaign that you're going through this adventure. And it's really great. I love a good fish out of water story. And I bring that up only to say that the element here of the occult book buyer is such a great subversion of that fish out of water story, where you uncover something about reality that you weren't meant to, and you get sucked into the organization that's dealing with that, rupture in reality or something along those lines. Here, you know, all the occult stuff is real, but you're just at the lowest possible level of dealing with it. You're a book mercenary, basically. Even though you know this stuff has real impacts, your role is almost neutral, though I suppose you could do almost anything. You could decide the book doesn't belong in any buyer's hand and take a reputation hit or something like that, lose your bookstore over the decisions you make in a campaign like this. And it's really, the whole system of the game is designed to allow for those kinds of consequences and impacts, and it's marvelous.
Yeah, let's dive in here and talk about what the player characters actually do in this story. I mean, ultimately, of course, the idea is that they will discover this secret weird business about Jack the Ripper, Beatus, and Nodens, though they don't know that up front, because it all starts just with being hired to purchase a rare occult book that is about to go up for auction. The book is from the 16th century. It's called Caedus Urbi Verae Claves, which is Latin for the true keys of the city of death. And as you will have guessed, right, it contains the ritual information about either opening or closing the Eye of Beatus, of course, among other things. There's a lot more in the book. This book itself has a really fun history. It has been stolen from its most recent owner. In fact, it seems, you know, always to transfer hands through some kind of nefarious means. And loads of people are looking for it. And this includes a rival team of bookhounds. And so there is a lot to get up to in the story before the final scene. That final scene is the auction where the bookhounds try to get the book. And then, of course, as you've said, Brandon, you as a group of players can decide what you actually want to do with the book, you know, if you actually succeed in getting it. I have to say, Brandon, I think that the plotting of this story is absolutely fantastic, though it's also a bit dizzying because it's just a really big story. This would be a lot of work for a game master. This is not a one shot. This really is, you know, something you're going to spend multiple sessions on. And, you know, as we said in our very first of these role-playing game episodes, you and I don't play role-playing games, at least not actively, not now, but I would definitely read a novelization of this. Like, this would definitely be my jam.
This is the kind of occult fiction I really like, is this sort of thing. What the occult represents is really these kinds of power grabs, I think, in my opinion. I guess there's a couple different ways to handle the occult, but usually the occult is about subverting the means of gaining power in kind of dominant culture. And so any kind of way to do that can be brought into, I don't know, occultation or something like that to some degree. And you can have magic or not. It doesn't really matter. But this, yeah, this is a perfect way to kind of investigate not just the occult in terms of the mystical, but the occult in terms of kind of culture in a minor key, right? Black markets versus, you know, the regular markets, criminality versus justice. All of these things that our major culture doesn't like to acknowledge as its counterpoint is where you can dump your energy into thinking about this game. I will say, in reading through Haidt's layout or his or the way he's organized this Whitechapel Black Letter section of the book, it is dizzying. It's, I mean, I had to read it like two or three times and I still don't feel like I have a handle on it because of the way it's organized. There's player, non-player character biographies, dialogue prompts, information about them, suggestions on how to play them. And through all of that is sprinkled in these other facts about the campaign that might be really important that you might want to bring the bookhounds through. There's locations to keep track of, clubs, gentlemen's clubs. And I don't mean, you know, we've been talking about, you know, pornography. I don't mean like strip clubs. I mean, you know, places where only gentlemen could be and they had to wear, you know, nice suits and so forth. There's mansions, there's auctions, there's all sorts of trouble to get up to here. And it is a big story and it's a big campaign. This is exactly the kind of occult story though, that is up my alley.
Yeah. One of the things that Haidt is trying to do here in the way that he's presenting this adventure is to give the game master everything that that person would need to have settings, have scenes, have non-player characters ready to go, depending on what the player characters decide to do. And the way that it's organized is that there are really only three core scenes that your players have to get to, and the rest of it is all up to them, right? And so a term that's often used in gaming, I mean, I think it's indigenous to role-playing games, but can be used in other types of gaming as well, is railroading versus allowing your players to simply go explore a sandbox. And Haidt has really tried to present this as a sandbox with some landmarks in it, rather than, you know, coming up with a narrative that requires players to go in a specific order. And he's also really leaning on the mechanics here. And of course, we're not, you know, focused on mechanics in our coverage of role-playing games, but he does focus on the mechanics here and is trying to come up with things for all sorts of different characters with all sorts of different abilities to be able to do that will contribute to what the group does. And so a lot of the writing of this adventure story is if your character is good at X, then that character will learn, you know, Y and Z that can be helpful to the group. If your character is good at A, then your character can learn, you know, C and D that will be helpful to the group. And it becomes a kind of tangled web that, you know, because you and I don't have a lot of experience doing this sort of thing, and certainly not running this sort of thing, looks, well, it made me hyperventilate thinking about actually having to run this. But I think that if you are someone who runs role-playing games and are looking for something that isn't a linear or doesn't require a linear progression, I think that the amount of work that Haidt has done here, the amount of material he's given you, I think would actually be incredibly helpful. This looks to me like the kind of adventure that, you know, people who really run adventures would be excited about.
Yeah, and you have to spend time with this text here and really absorb all of the information that Haidt has given you in order to really fill out the adventure. And he also says, hey, if that's not your strong suit and you can't wade through all these waters, you know, follow the Chandler law of writing and just have two acolytes in robes, you know, brandishing knives, bust into the room when it's time to move your bookhounds along. And so, yeah, he's got a good sense of humor about, you know, what he's given. And his goal here is to get people involved in a good story. And I think he's accomplished that, but it's challenging. I mean, it's a lot to absorb. He's done a lot of work here. And I want to just take a moment before we move on here. If you're kind of tracking with what I put out in the first episode as thinking of these as aids in crafting your own sort of novel. This is one of the books that shows you a clear distinction between role-playing storytelling and novel storytelling or short story storytelling. This can give you some good ideas. You and I, Glenn, have been trading, you know, ideas, prompts, adventure concepts, all back and forth. But when you have a sandbox, you really can't have your novel be a sandbox. And so you have to make the choices and you have to do this and that for the sake of storytelling. So this is one of these texts that got me thinking, okay, what is the difference between setting up a good adventure, a world for people to play in? And what is, you know, what's the difference between that and forcing characters down a path to make a satisfying story work? What are the character journeys? What are their motivations? And this is something that I think is really worth thinking about. And this Bookhounds of London book really can be a great source of prompts, but also highlight the difference between a tabletop role playing and writing a story for an audience.
Many people have actually turned their role-playing game campaigns into fairly successful novels, but definitely you're going to make some alterations there, that they are not the same type of storytelling, even just in terms of medium, they're very different, but also in terms of what the participants are looking for is also very, very different. But you're completely right that this book is full of excellent hooks and certainly had me thinking a lot about storytelling. And that's the penultimate thing we want to do here, actually, is just present some of our own ideas for a Bookhounds campaign hook to each other and just, yeah, riff on some storytelling prompts here a little bit. What's an idea or some ideas that you've got, Brandon?
Because Height kept on bringing up a Machen throughout this source book, I thought we'd have to do something with Dyson. And we're in the 1930s, so Dyson is maybe in his 50s or 60s at this point, maybe a little older. Maybe he's opened up a bookstore or, you know, he could be a player character, but I think he's better as kind of the quest giver in a sense, or the, I don't know, the person who you're working for. He's an expert on many subjects. He's amassed contacts that range from, you know, tramps to high society and academia as well. He's well respected in the occult scene. And maybe you work for Dyson's shop as a scout. He's the guide or wizard type figure. Somewhere along the way, you've got to end up in the alleyways or sewers of London, or maybe some caves and some London woods, I don't know, tracking down a book or an object. Basically, you know, what I just kind of sketched out initially in my head was something like a Batman Beyond kind of story, but with Dyson as the Batman figure, and you're taking up the mantle to keep the business afloat and keep dangerous occult items out of the hands of the foolish or villains.
This is a great idea for some, you know, recurring stories, right? Where this is always the gimmick, that Dyson is the character who gives you what the adventure is that you're going to spend 2, 3, maybe, you know, 5 sessions playing. And then eventually, of course, you know, when you're wanting to wrap this up or move it into a new direction, you have your players go to Dyson to get the, you know, adventure of the week, and Dyson is dead. You know, Dyson's murdered in his bookshop or something like that, right? Now it's graduation time. And yeah, that would all be real exciting. I love the idea of bringing Dyson. I love the idea of bringing Dyson into this.
Yeah, I just couldn't get it out of my head. I mean, Machen is invoked so much here, and I love the Dyson character so much. I wish Machen had done more with him or been a little bit more consistent with him, and this would be my opportunity to really dig into Dyson's relationship with the occult, which I think is far more interesting. Even his mode of thought as a character is occulted from, you know, as I've been pointing out, kind of the dominant culture, this different way of thinking. But I don't know, Glenn, what are some ideas that you had for a good hook?
Well, I have 3 because I'm mad with power, but also I will say that none of them are actually set in 1930s London. So I took the brief and maybe crumpled it up a little bit and did my own thing. But where this had you thinking about Dyson, and I'm super glad that it did, this actually had me thinking about my own occult detective, Paul Henslow. And I have two ideas here. One of them actually is a Henslow story, but the first idea is simply that I was really interested in this business with Jack the Ripper in Whitechapel Black Letter. And I think you could actually tell another version of this story, or, you know, a prequel to this story that's actually set during the Ripper killings, right? That some kind of occult detective has to stop Jack the Ripper before he completely closes the Eye of Beatus. And, you know, you could just do that story. You could write that. You could do that as a role-playing game, a kind of prequel to this. That might actually be fun to do after you've had your players actually play through this adventure. So even just in the canned adventure, I think there are like spin-off possibilities there.
Oh, yeah.
That would be a lot of fun to have.
Yeah. And, you know, you could then use Alan Moore's From Hell as another source to get ideas from and set the mood and the setting and all of that stuff. But maybe avoid that film. If you want to watch a Johnny Depp cult detective movie, watch The Ninth Gate, you know, not From Hell.
Yeah, definitely The Ninth Gate, not From Hell. Reading this book, though, did also make me want to go write an actual Henslow story. Of course, Henslow stories are set in a fake 1850s London, a kind of fantasy London. And my thought there was to have Henslow discover that someone in our fake 1850s London is making books that are bound in human skin, and that they are taking the skin from living people because, I don't know, powerful magic or something like that, you know, mythos reasons, occult reasons for doing that. And Henslow enters into this story as a kind of missing person case, right? Someone's, you know, important person is missing. They go to Henslow, and then Henslow eventually discovers what's actually going on here. And because it's a Henslow story, it has to have a bleak ending where he doesn't actually really put a stop to anything. And in fact, just discovers that lots of people are really interested in buying books bound in human skin for nefarious purposes that he would rather not dwell on.
I love your Henslow story so much, Glenn. I think you need to write this one. It's such a good idea. And people who are interested in reading Glenn's Henslow stories, I think, I don't know, aren't some available on our website? I don't know. They're out there. You should track them down. They're fantastic, and they make me jealous every time I read one. And write this one, Glenn. Go do it.
Yeah. Well, I do need one more. I do need to write one more so that we can actually publish a Henslow collection, which was on our docket before COVID happened. And then everything changed after that. So we never got around to it. Well, look, I've got one last pitch here, Brandon, before we wrap things up. And this one, well, maybe I won't say anything about it here other than to say that it also is not set in London in the 1930s. But in fact, it's not set in London or any version of London at all. Rather, it is set in central Illinois in the 1950s. Our player characters, though, are from London, and the deal is that they have been sent to the town of Cashinsville because someone who worked as a book forger in London in the 1940s may have run off with a real mythos book that needs to be recovered. That person, of course, is Lou Gold, and here I am turning Gene Wolfe's novel Peace into a Bookhounds of London scenario, which I think is the only correct thing to do here.
I had the same exact idea this week, and I decided to stay in the 1930s and in London and didn't pitch this, that somehow we'd have to bring Lou Gold into this world because he's perfect for it. And my idea was he forged a book that turned out to have real power, as was his kind of pitch to the main character of Peace, Alden Weir. So yeah, I think we're making Peace sound more occulty than it is, but there's a lot of occult stuff in Peace as well.
There is, and we don't really get Lou Gold's backstory. I mean, we get a backstory, but it's clear, you know, he's moved around, right? He had to leave Germany because of Nazis and the war, and then went to London where he met his wife, and then they moved to Chicago, and from there down to this smaller town in central Illinois. And, you know, there's some plausible reasons for all of this moving around. But as we are getting those explanations in Peace, it always feels like there is more to that story. There is some secret that Lou Gold is hiding. And of course, there are actual secrets that he is hiding that we discover. But I think that we could flesh that out a little bit. I also think this is a place where somebody could, you know, have their say about what really happened to Lois, you know, bring her into this somehow. Maybe she actually was, in fact, a bookhound from London, just pretending to be from St. Louis. That's actually why Weir couldn't quite figure out what her accent was, is because it was a fake accent and she wasn't getting it quite right. You know, there's lots of things you could do there. And I think the idea of turning even some segment of piece into a role-playing game is the thing that is missing from Gene Wolfe fandom.
The pulpiest possible thing you could do with this story is have Lou Gold steal an occult book from Hitler himself. I mean, that's the starting point, I think. And you can just go from there. Anything occult and Nazis is going to get pulp blood flowing, I think, and people with that sort of imagination.
Well, the next time somebody's putting together a collection of Gene Wolfe fan fiction, of which there are several, I hope you will contact us. Brandon and I would love to write rival versions of the Lou Gold Bookhound's backstory here, and readers can decide which they like best. Well, let's start to close this one out. Brandon, let's just offer up some final thoughts about this book. And I'll start here just by saying that I absolutely adored this book. I didn't quite know what to expect when I cracked the covers of it, other than that I knew I liked Ken Heidt's podcast and that I had liked some of his other role-playing work that I had encountered. But I wasn't really sure what to expect in terms of the layout of the book and what the canned adventure was going to be like and so on. And I wound up just really enjoying all of the hours that I spent with this, even, you know, knowing that we're never actually going to play this game. I just found looking through this book, having it out on the table, flipping through it, going back and forth, looking at different things, was a great way for me to pass a few hours this week. I really, really enjoyed it. But one thing that I will say in particular that I loved about this book is you keep bringing up all of the research that Ken Heidt did for this book. Much of that makes its way into the book. Heidt shows the work. He gives you other books that you ought to go read. He tells you what he read and tells you which of them you should go read as well. So there's a great bibliography here for anyone who is interested in learning more about London in the 1930s, learning more about rare books, learning more about occult books. And really, for me, that is a big component for why I'm going to make sure that when Finch, it gets to be about fifth grade, sixth grade, maybe, this book is out for him to find, because I think there are a lot of rabbit holes in this book that I would love for him as an adolescent to go down.
Well, we've already put aside seed money so that our kids can start their own occult detective agency when they're 12 or 13 or something like that. But this book really blew me away. It is right up my alley in so many ways, in terms of its content and the research, the history you get here, but also the types of characters you can create. The world is so deep. This, you know, Ken Heidt has got to be the top of this industry, right? Are there many people that are putting out better work than Ken Heidt? And, you know, he's legendary. And this book is an example of why that is. And I don't know, while we're telling you, you need to pick up this book if you haven't. You should also pick up Glenn's Hanselow stories. You can find links to them, I think, on our website. I think those links are still up, but I'm not sure. And on that note, we're going to say farewell. So once again, I'm Brandon Buda.
And I'm Glenn McDormand. As always, you can find us and our other creative projects at claytemplemedia.com. That does include links to at least a handful of my Hanselow stories, which hopefully we will actually have out in a real book form at some point, as opposed to just available in some magazines that had published them. While you are looking us up on the internet, though, we also hope that you will join us on Patreon at patreon.com/claytemplemedia so that you can gain access to well over 100 bonus episodes. Next time here on Elder Sign, we will be back with a commissioned episode on Confessions of a Mask, which is the next installment in Alan Moore's novel Voice of the Fire. And after that, we'll be back with our regularly scheduled episode on Angel Language, which is the next installment in Alan Moore's Voice of the Fire. And until then, we greet you and say farewell.